welcome to The Parent Equation with me, Aisha Murray. I'm a coach and I primarily support working parents and carers who believe that parenthood shouldn't be a barrier to a successful and fulfilling career. In this podcast series, I chat to inspirational working parents and ask them to share their own experiences of raising children alongside their careers. We talk about the struggles and the moments of joy. And I hope in each episode, there's something that can bring you a bit more strength and positivity. So please follow, listen, and subscribe on all major platforms. So today I'm joined by Carey Davis Munro. Carey is a well-being and food coach, the founder of Eat, Nourish, Flourish, a published writer this year, which also is called Eat, Nourish, Flourish, 12 Steps to Healthier Family Food. So welcome, Carey, and thank you so much for being on today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. No, I'm really, really pleased to be here. I'm loving listening to your podcast so far.
Thank you. Thank you. And there's a few areas I want to cover today, and hopefully we have time. The first is obviously your journey as a parent and through your career. And the second I definitely want to cover, maybe selfishly, is nutrition, family nutrition, and trying to get kids out of this whole standard, what would you like for dinner, fish fingers or pizza, please, mentality.
Yes.
Because that's where I, especially with kids being at home so much, we're all getting stuck in that rut, I think, and not knowing really how to break out of that. So a couple of things. So let's just start with your journey and your parenthood journey, a bit about your kids and how your career has fitted in with that over the years.
Yeah, gosh, and I could talk for hours about this. So I have three children. So I have currently a son who's just turned 19, a son who's just turned 15, and I have a 16-year-old daughter. So they were all very close together. And when I had my first son, I was working in HR. So I was pregnant and working in a job in HR. And then I left and decided that after I'd had him, I didn't want to go back and do that. Didn't want to go back and work within a business. So I set up my own HR business and own HR consultancy. So throughout all of their births, I guess, and throughout their younger times and now their older times, I have been a working mum. But because it didn't sort of ring true to me to be, you know, I wanted my children around me, I guess I sort of killed myself, as many parents do, to drop him at nursery as late as I could, my first son, and then pick him up as early as I could. Being the way I am with food, I made all his lunches, I packed all his treats. So I was paying for this nursery, basically, Aisha, that I didn't really, you know, I wasn't utilizing properly because I was collecting him early and I didn't really want him to be there and then trying to work for myself in between. You know what it's like, that there is no good solution there. So there's no ideal. And I have to say, I was very, very lucky because my mum at that point, who lives in Southampton, would drive up once a week and she would spend time with me and she would be there as well. So the nursery thing didn't really work, and it didn't work because I was paying for it and not using it and supplying all his food and everything else. So with my second and third child, I didn't do that. I tried to work from home and parent at the same time, and then plugged the gaps, as again so many people do, with my mum. My husband at the time was then working, and you know, I think he very much saw this as a division of labor thing, but I was also trying to work or set up businesses or complete contracts or do whatever. So and I think because of that, and because I was the one with the children, you know, what happens is they became very attached to me. My children had some separation anxiety, all three of them. And then when my first son started school, he went from this most joyous child who loved learning, who, you know, was so thoughtful and so, you know, lovely to everybody around him. He started to go a little bit introvert, and moving from, I think it was year one to year two, or even the nursery to year one, when they started to, you know, really life was taken much more seriously and the play was taken out of it. I could see he was struggling. And eventually he sort of moved to a point where he became very difficult to get into school, and when I spoke to the school, they said they sort of thought I was making it up, or they, you know, it was that sort of thing where you're having those conversations, but I was made to feel like I was making a fuss about nothing. Anyway, it took taking him off to a psychologist and having a diagnosis of extreme dyslexia and dyscalculia, which is the same thing with maths and numbers. And then he became to be, you know, with more and more withdrawn, quite anxious, not coping with school very well. And then he had an acute onset of epilepsy. So he was in and out of hospitals for about a term. They didn't know exactly what was causing it. And at the time, I have to say, I thought I was going mad, because it didn't manifest itself in the same way that other epilepsy does. He didn't have, at the beginning, he didn't have a tonic fit or anything like that. It looked like he couldn't breathe. So I took him to doctor after doctor, because he would do this thing. You know, when you're just about to sneeze, you go, and you look like you're catching your breath. Yeah. Anyway, so I took him to the doctor, and the GP said, oh, I've never seen anything like it. I don't know. I think it's just anxiety. Is it anxiety? You know, looking at him and me thinking, this is just useless. Then I would take him back again, see a different GP. And again, no idea, not seeing this. We don't think there's anything wrong, nothing to worry about. School were extremely dismissive. And I was batting up against, you know, head teacher, deputy all the time. And then eventually, I took him to a walk-in hospital. They said nothing was wrong. And then she said, oh, it's very interesting. When you do find out what it is, could you tell me what it is? Because maybe it's something wrong with his throat. And I thought, well, the last thing I'll be doing is coming back and telling you. Anyway, eventually, it was getting more and more. So he was having these episodes more and more frequently. And I sat him up in bed one night with me. Partner was in China, or, you know, he was abroad and worked away a lot. And I just watched my son all night, and he was having more and more of these things. And eventually he did go into clonic tonic. So he went to emergency in the middle of the night. And again, Kingston Hospital told me nothing was wrong, nothing to follow up on. It was just one of those things, kicked him out. And I spent the day on the phone, having had no sleep for weeks at this point, because I was just so worried about it. And eventually I had a pediatrician look at him. And I had to take him to a private hospital to get somebody to look at him at this point. And he just looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said to him, I'm not going mad, am I? There's something really wrong here. And he said, yeah, you're not going mad. Mm-hmm. He ordered MRIs. He ordered telemetry. He ordered a sleep deficit test for him. And, you know, then they biked samples. You know, they were doing lumbar punctures. They biked samples off all around the country. And it was a terrible, terrible time. But, you know, almost it was that point where I'd felt quite lonely, because again, my husband at that point was just saying, oh, you know, leave it, if you just stop worrying, everything will be okay. And sort of everybody was telling me I was going mad, and I knew I wasn't going mad, because as a mum, well, and one know, thing I was yeah, you know. You bloody well know, as a mum, yeah, you've got this feeling. And I would always say to anybody, just keep going, because that intuition that you have, mm-hmm. is always right. In my experience with three children, you're always right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the long and short of it is he was on meds then, and he was on meds to control it. They still didn't know really what was wrong until about a year and a half ago, when they found something in his brain, this little bit that they found on an MRI that this wonderful consultant had always been looking for. And they decided to, well, actually, the option of surgery for me had always been an absolute no-go area. There was no way I'd have said yes to that. But my son was nearly 18, and he said, yes,
oh, really? Okay.
I'm going to have that, because I want a normal life. I don't want to be on meds. So it was something called cortical dysplasia, which is just a part in the brain that's a bit foamy and it doesn't really do anything. So yeah, he went through a 7-hour brain surgery just over a year ago. He was a bit like Superman. He came out, and well, I have to say, I always say to people, as a mum, it was the worst day of my life, and then it was the best day of my life. Because when he came out and I saw him in ICU and he had all these blood drains coming off his head, etc., yeah, he was looking, when he was going, hey, mom, I'm all right. Because I'd actually said to him, please don't have it done. And he's like, no. And we'd walked into the theatre, me and his dad. And, you know, the day before he'd said to me, you can't come, mom. I was a bit of a mess the day before, and we'd had the consultation, because I just kept saying, but you're perfect. You know, you're perfect. You don't need this. Life is okay. Okay, there was not much you can do. He couldn't have a drink. He wouldn't have been able to drive. But for him, that was a step too far. Yeah. And so he said to me the night before, you can't come. And I said, no, I've pulled myself together. Don't worry. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. And in the hospital in the morning, I'd spoken to the surgeon who came in, and we were there, you know, pre 7 o'clock. And the first thing I said to him was, did you get a good night's sleep? And Sam's looking at me like rolling his eyes, asking. So we rolled him into the theater, and he looked up at us and he just went, you two can go now. And we did the thing again. We said, look, you can still back out. You can still say no. Yeah. Just leave, just leave. And we both sort of collapsed outside the theatre, because it was, you know, he could have gone on without it. And the risks for me, I mean, I won't go over the risks, but the risks were just too great. Could have lost movement down one side, etc. Anyway, so the long and short of it is he is absolutely fine. He made something of a miraculous discovery. The surgeon couldn't believe when he saw him the next day, and he left the hospital within a few days. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. And it was the best thing. And he is living his best life, because school for him was purgatory. They never got it right for him. I moved him. I should have moved his primary school way before I did. And eventually I did move it, and it was the best 8 months of his whole school career when I moved his primary eventually. I should have done it much earlier. But I was umming and ahhing because he had this anxiety all hooked up with everything that was going on. And then secondary school was absolutely wrong for him. And I should have taken him out, and I should have tried to do it differently. But I was also a working mum. I knew that for a child that, you know, didn't want to school anyway, to self-school would have been incredibly hard. But looking back on it now, you know, there's schooling and there's schooling, and for GCSEs and for going through that process, as I say, purgatory is not, it's a hard word, but it's actually the one that I would use, because I spent 5 years battling to get him the support that he needed. There were some real screw ups through his GCSEs in terms of the support that he was meant to have and he didn't have. And it was wrong. You know, that's a journey that so many people, you know, so many parents have when children have different needs and special needs. Yeah, but yeah. And he did. He had a complex set of needs, and he had his, you know, in the olden days it was called a statement, but then he had his EHCP, his education, health and welfare plan. But it was not implemented properly ever. And so he didn't get what he needed. So that was a journey in itself. Yeah, that's my oldest son. But don't forget that I had two other younger children that I was dealing with at the time. And my daughter had a period where she, again, behaviorally, and I don't know if it was what was going on with the other two, really went off the scale. So I was trying to juggle taking her to see someone, a play specialist, to find out what was going on there. And then when my younger son was born, and they were all born within, you know, I had three children under 3 and a half. My younger son had some medical issues, so he had to go back in and have an operation. And then he didn't eat, and he wasn't eating properly, and everybody was telling me to put him on thickening drugs, and the hospital were telling me to put on drugs, and that didn't sit well with me, because I don't do that. I do everything naturally. So I carried on breastfeeding, and I took him to see, in between all these other appointments, I took him to see a naturopath and somebody who was it's a chiropractor, but it sounds very strange. So he was working on people's tummies and energies and different things. So he worked on his tummy muscles and things within his abdomen to try and help the eating. Yeah. So I was taking him for, when he was born, I was taking him for daily appointments to try and make that work, and so worried about him. And sleep, goodness me, sleep. I mean, what was that? I think I went through years just really not understanding what sleep was about, because I was dealing with major issues with all three children, and then they, you know, different anxieties around that. So when I look back, look, I know I didn't have an easy journey, because it wasn't just one child. There were different things with all three of them. And so I, you know, I came to a point where I was pretty exhausted, and I, in terms of the work split, yeah, it was more that traditional. My husband at the time was very much, well, I'm working and I'm doing that, but I had too much to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
Even one of those things would have been too much to deal with. Mm-hmm. And so I came to a point where I was thinking, gosh, well, I'm dealing with all that, and I couldn't deal with the relationship on top of that. So I decided that if I had so much to do, I needed to just focus on the children. So yeah. That's when I decided it was probably better I was a single parent, because I'd felt like a single parent dealing with those things for quite a long time. Yeah, so that was their younger life. And from that point, I mean, I have to say, I think that in terms of the relationship, I think often, and you know, I don't say this as a blanket because I know so many are different, there's some wonderful, wonderful fathers, but I think I was a buffer almost for his relationship with them. Because I managed everything. So it would be, you know, they'd wait and see if he came from the bus stop and he wouldn't get home till 7:30 at night. And then probably he'd be too tired to do a story. So then they might be a bit disappointed. And then I would do the story. And then when he did ever go to interact, they didn't actually want him. So he had this joke, well, I'm just the wrong parent. Like the wrong parent, because most of the time I am doing it all. Yeah. So of course that's what they know and that's what they want. And then, you know, I think I was a buffer for that relationship. And then after, you know, we weren't together, he had to build that relationship himself. Yep. And very successfully. And I think that in many ways, in terms of their relationship with him, I did everybody a favor there, because they had to all find their own way. And I wasn't that buffer and I wasn't that go-between. And in terms of parenting, he's done everything that, you know, you would want him to do, and sees them regularly, cooks for them, because, you know, he'd seen a lot of cooking going on. So there's some lovely, you know, in that way, I think that it turned out better than I could have hoped.
But you say that you were single parenting anyway, so therefore you made the decision to separate.
Yes.
You had, obviously, as you've just explained to us, an extremely traumatic experience with your three children as they were growing up, with all their different challenges and issues. So even that said, it's still a very brave step for you to separate from someone who could be a support or could be an extra person to talk to in the household. But even with all that going on, you still felt the need and had the courage to break away from something that wasn't working.
Yeah, I did, because do you know what? I think at one point I was speaking to somebody from a charity or an organization about my daughter on the phone. I think Sam was going through he wasn't having surgery at the time, but anyway, I was dealing with what he was, you know, the meds. We were always having to change his meds or to manage that, or I was always managing stuff that was going on at school, and always the one managing the schoolwork, which is the most stressful of all, because when you've got children, you know, my daughter, then I tested her, she had aspects of dyscalculia, she processed in a different way. So in terms of supporting the homeschooling, that was me. And that was the most stressful part. So I wasn't only supporting doing all the things that you do as mum, but I was then doing the homeschooling that everybody's doing now. Yeah, because I was having to give so much extra help, and they needed extra help. And so then I was trying to find extra help, and who could I get me to help, you know, get to help me with all of this. And in terms of that, the conversations that I then had, because I guess I then felt resentful that, why can't you see what I'm dealing with? Mm. You know, why am I? And I had a conversation, as I said, I think it again was with a psychologist around what my daughter's behavior at the time. And she said, what's, and I explained that I was having to go to appointments. And she said, what's your husband doing? What's he doing? I said, oh, well, he's at work. And she said, well, you know, you've got to do this 50-50. And I remember having a conversation saying, I know you're doing the work stuff, but I'm doing all the emotional. And do you understand what the emotional means? Mm. You know, I've been told I can't deal with all the emotional. And sometimes, you know, men, not a criticism, men deal with things in a different way. Yep. You know, we do deal with the emotional. That's the way we're made. And he didn't. He was very practical. So whereas I'd say, look, I'm really upset about this, he would turn to me and he would say, don't be, or get over it. And he didn't mean in a nasty way necessarily, but it's just like, well, you've got the choice. You know, often as a coach now, I look back and I think, you know, I do say to people, you've got a choice how you react to things. And I'm very aware of that. But gommy, you know, I wasn't just dealing with a little bit of emotion over something. You know, these were it was my children who were going through massive, massive things at the time. So he could see things very black and white. So in terms of the emotional support, I would then turn to family, my sister I'm very close to, you know, girlfriends or whatever. And that's where I got my support from. So when you say it was a brave decision, there was nothing that I felt that I was losing in terms of the support that I needed. And you know what? In the back of my mind, I'd grown up in a family where my dad walked out when I was seven. We were out on the lawn. He threw us and all our stuff out on the lawn at seven. And I grew up at seven. I know that was the minute that I became an adult and started managing other adults. Or, you know, my mum and him that went through a breakdown. I started managing them around me. So I sort of, all my life, I'd been prepared for worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And always I don't do this now because I've gone through a whole sort of self learning process, but always I'd never put myself in a situation that I couldn't manage 100%, get in, get out, and know that I could do it. And I also knew, I'd seen it, you know, I always also thought that when I have children, whatever happens, I need to be able to manage this on my own.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen what had happened. I'd been to worst case scenario and it had been pretty brutal. And we'd gone through some horrific times, you know, physical, mental, all sorts. So I just knew that I had to be able to manage that at any point. So knowing that I was exhausted on my knees and I felt quite, you know, well, in a relationship, there has to be a balance and a mutual respect and an equality. And I felt that because I was managing all that the equality had gone. You know, I didn't have that mutual respect. I didn't have the respect for what I was dealing with, maybe. And therefore, that made me lose the respect.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm dealing with all this anyway. You know, and then there would be jokes. I'd be doing something for the children. But, well, what about me? And it would be a joke, but I'd look as if, what about you? I'm dead on my knees. You know, you're an adult. You need to do what about you? But, you know, things are a two-way thing. I don't say that this is a one-way thing by any stretch of the imagination. Things are two-way. And as I said, I know that I'm a product of my own patterning that we talk about in coaching. Yeah. And that I had been in a situation when I was young where I thought, right, I need to always be able to take control and take anything on. And I did think that when I had, you know, when I think that when we're mums and we have children, it's a different situation. I think you have children and you might or might not be in a relationship, but that link and that responsibility, it's very rare, isn't it, that a mum walks away or, you know, those situations are rare and we talk about them rarely where the mum just up and left or whatever, or what happened. And you know almost that that's it. You are responsible. You're in for the long run, aren't you?
Yeah. And interestingly, you mentioned that actually, because the podcast that will be live when your podcast is live, so will be live already by then, was with a wonderful guy called Michael Ray, who's Australian. And he's a solo dad, as he calls it, because his partner left and his two-year-old daughter. And I said to him on the podcast, as a mum, I can't imagine leaving my child, especially as a young child, I'm not saying any age, but a two-year-old child, to just decide that's it. I don't want to have any part of her life. I'm off. But that's what happened to him. And he had to change, as he put it, from a very stereotypical kind of macho Aussie bloke to someone who could talk to his daughter about periods and about dating and about all these things that are going to happen to her as a daughter.
Yeah,
fully embraced it and has now become a massive champion for gender equality, for the rights of girls and women and workplaces.
Yes.
It's an amazing story. But as you say, it is very rare. You don't hear those stories very often where it is that way around.
Yeah, you don't. But I do think that sometimes, as I said, I do think that when you've got the mum there all the time, we do act as a buffer. Obviously, my daughter's going to talk to me about the time of the month and about those things. And she's not, you know, she wouldn't have ever talked to her about her dad, but, you know, he is actually, he's very supportive of women and very supportive of her and dance and all of that. But she wouldn't necessarily go and talk to him. And I would always be her first port of call. Yeah. But yeah. I think that in a household where those things are going on, you're always first in line for all those conversations. Mm-hmm. And take you out, well, then there has to be somebody else. Yeah. And yeah, they'd have to deal with it in a you know, an adult and an adequate way, because that you're that person around. So I think it's lovely that he's done that, because it does open your eyes to what they're dealing with, or what we deal with each month, and what girls go through. But I think that sometimes we act as a buffer, and that's a shame in a way. I love the fact that she now take, you know, he calls her and they have interactions, and that's brilliant, because I'm hand on my heart, I don't think that would have happened if he'd stayed. And they now have, I've said this to them over the years, I think actually you have a far better relationship because he's had to contact you, and he's had, you know, all of those things. And you know, as I said, hands up, he's done it brilliantly and does stay in touch with them, and they know that he's always been there, and they've built great relationships, great holidays, you know, done lots of lovely things that I wouldn't do, and I think that that's fantastic.
Yes, as you say, you don't call it brave, I still will, your brave step to move away from it those years ago has actually been the best thing for them, hasn't it? So that is
maybe
a positive thing.
I think maybe you were right, maybe it was brave, but there's also the situation of, well, do you stay in an unhappy situation? Because that sometimes takes bravery as well, knowing that something isn't right for you. And I've always been someone, it's funny, out of that situation that I was saying when I was 7, my sister's 5.5 years older than me, out of that, and we moved, I don't know, 5 times in a year, we had so much change. My sister is the opposite. She doesn't do change. And for me, I switch it up at a moment, and you know, I was a teacher and I left teaching, and people were like, you can't leave teaching, you know, people don't leave, what are you going to do, what are you going to do? And someone I'd played international netball with at the time, her husband had started a business, and she said, come and do this. I thought, god, I went from outside on a rounders pitch and playing field to going inside in an office. It was flipping scary. But that's but actually it wasn't right for me what I was doing anymore. It just wasn't right. So change it. And that's why I'm a coach, really. It's about what's next. Let's change it. You know, what's working for you? What would I like instead of? And I didn't know instead of was going to be better, but I did know where I wasn't right. And there's no, you know, I said to a client last week, there's no guarantees in life. We don't have any guarantees. And so maybe it was brave, but I did know that if I stayed where I was, I wasn't happy. And I didn't feel that I could do anything to get back to where I'd been. So for me, the brave thing, I guess, I don't know, some people do stay and that takes bravery. But for me, I needed to switch it up, and the next thing might not have been any, you know, better. But I wasn't happy where I was, and I didn't feel that as a parent for my children, even in that place, they weren't getting the best of me.
So where did coaching come in then, and how did he then transition and change it up again from the HR corporate world, and how did he get out of that and go into coaching? When did that happen?
Yeah, I sort of see that as almost sort of one and the same thing. So I had been a teacher, and so came from a teaching family. So I'd been a teacher and then run my own business with the HR. But background of HR, sort of learning and development is my thing, and culture and, you know, change and change is a theme, really, isn't it? And so really embedded culture and managing people, and then people and well-being. I mean, well-being and health and physical health has been a theme as well. I used to play quite high-end sports, so and then organizations, really. And when I was working in HR, I was fascinated with the idea that people would spend loads and loads of money on training and, you know, and loads of money on recruitment, but if you haven't got somebody who's motivated and well to be there, it's all a waste of money. So I became really interested in the idea of presenteeism, and, you know, what percentage of that of effort we actually get from a person at work if they're not motivated to be there, and how you build an organization so that people feel part of it, and embedding that within it so that you're getting the most from your people. And that people are developed. So I guess that was always the whole coaching thing was integral to that, and where I were, you know, the way I was working with people. And then I ran, I've run some food businesses. I ran a business for children in the summer holidays, and started different businesses. But then When I had my food business, my eldest son was going through his GCSEs, and I needed to spend more time. And then out of that, and working within the food industry and working with other companies as well, I was doing lots of work with people where, again, coaching is an integral part. And so I went along and just decided to learn more. Loved it and thought, yeah, that is me. This is me. It's, you know, I've always been, when I'm sometimes annoyingly so, people will talk to me about something that's going on and I'm not able to just say, oh, yes, you know, poor you, or yeah, that's awful. I'm like, oh, yeah, that is. But what are we going to do about it? What's going to happen next? Yeah. Where are you going? What do we do with this? Because talking about things that are bad for the sake of talking about something that's bad, for me, that's just a waste of life. So it's always been about, okay, well, what do we do about that? What could you do? What are your options? And so, yeah, I just thought, wow, yeah, I need to formally qualify and do this. And then the food thing, again, ever since, I was young, I played lots of sport, hammered my body. It was my control, I think. I think that, again, it was about having control from what had happened in my childhood. And my body had crashed. So I was diagnosed, a little way actually before the split in the marriage with stress-induced chronic fatigue. Yes, unsurprisingly, with what was going on. Yeah. I'd spoken to somebody who was a nutritionist and also did courses from the Institute of Nutrition, did some home studies, and again became fascinated with the fact that we absolutely are what we eat and that we have the power over how well we are in life through our food and through what we do to our bodies, what we put on our bodies and what we put in our bodies. So that was, and I started to work around that subject and read voraciously around it. So when I was studying to become a coach, it wasn't like, well, what will my niche be? That's what I'd work with people on. I'd run food workshops. I'd run workshops for mums, and been I'd gone and done talks and been a speaker on the subject. So for me, the coaching and the food was hand in hand. It was all very logical that would be the next step. And it's sort of written through me like a stick of rock. It's my absolute passion. It's the way I brought my children up. As I said, even when my son was going to nursery, I'd collected him, or I'd packed up all his lunch. I'd packed up all his snacks, much to their amusement. I've always cooked an evening meal from fresh, however tired I am, because I know that that's the most important thing that I can do for them every day. Yeah. So, yeah, it was a logical progression, really. Health, wellness and fitness. I was a physical education teacher. I taught.
Yeah, it all goes hand in hand.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's the thing about coaching, isn't it? You have to coach in the area that you are passionate about and that you can naturally step into. So there's no point coaching something which you're not passionate about or haven't done before, haven't experienced. You coach something that you know will work and you know you're passionate about and your life is around that, which for you, obviously, it is around food and well-being.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, you know, at the moment, I coach people around everything. So I do a lot of business coaching. I do, which is the whole thing, isn't it? When you're a coach, you can coach anything. And I love, you know, career coaching. I even got a few, you know, I talk about triggers in some of the coaching I'm doing is to change habits, and there's always a trigger, and that's often the relationship. So one thing leads to another. What you start coaching on doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily the thing that you finish on. And then doing some coaching in education at the moment as well. So that's lovely. I do love the diversity. And obviously my book is on food, and that is something that I put out there. But I do love the fact that I coach people all over the world and in so many different areas of coaching. Yeah. Because the thing is with the food, people sort of say, look at me, you know, I coach. We don't give you advice. We don't tell you what to do. They're like, but you've done all this. So you know, why aren't you? So I will say to them during the relationship, and I recontract and say, look, we'll go through a process, and then I'll say, well, okay, obviously I have done this. Would you like me to offer you some other alternatives or some tips here, my top tips here or whatever? And so we recontract, and then it becomes something slightly different. People think as a coach, you're just going to give them, this is the way that you should do it. And that's not the way, obviously, because we know that people make changes and sustain those changes if they've decided the pace at which they do them and then instigated the actions.
So let's talk about your book then and how it can help people like me and mums like me and dads who are potentially stuck in a rut is definitely the best way to describe it, with kids and family, not family nutrition so much, because my husband and I eat really well, and we always have done, mainly because my husband's good influence on me. But there's something about transferring that great intention that we have in our eating to my children, who, if you ask them what they want for dinner, it's bog standard response of fish fingers or pizza, stir-fried rice, which is slightly more out there, but that's about as far as we get. So how do you change the mentality of a child and start to get them thinking about expanding their horizons when it comes to food?
Yeah, it's a tricky question because, you know, predictably, again, when I had my children, I did never have those things in the house. Yeah. So they would never have said, I want this or I want that. Now, they would have had it when they'd gone out to friends. Yeah. And then they'd have, you know, if they went for tea, usually the standard thing, it's either pizza or it's pesto pasta, white pasta, and then pesto out of a jar. And that was usually the dinner. Yeah. And then they would come to me and I would cook a full meal. And so it's difficult because, you know, one, I would say if you're about to have a baby, start from the very beginning, embed those habits. Mm. Two, I have never done a split dinner where I've eaten one thing and my children have eaten another. I don't see the point of that. You know, I don't understand that. Again, you go into a pub and they'll have the children's menu. It is nutritionally deplete. And that's an understatement. You know, the stuff that you're going to give them, the pizza, the pasta, the white pastas, it is nutrient free almost. Yeah. So therefore I would say, and you know, this, the whole podcast is called The Parent Equation. We parent passionately on every other subject. We wouldn't want our child having alcohol. We wouldn't want our child having drugs. We want the best education for them. Why, when it comes to food, are we happy to run them to the tutor or run them to the swimming lesson, bring them home and put something in front of them, which doesn't measure up? These are growing individuals. So I would say you have to parent as strongly on food, much stronger actually. It's the relationship that's going to last them throughout their whole lives. We become, our bodies are made, it's personal, our cells are only made from every mouthful that we take. So start educating them from a young age. And one of the things that I used to say to my children, and they laugh about this was my mantra, you know, outside school, I think it's criminal that the ice cream vans are allowed to be there, and you know, and the sweets and all of that, it's just criminal. And you know, the first time my first son had sweets was I picked him up at lunchtime from school, and for birthdays they'd allowed them all to bring sweets in. He took a packet of sweets up and they all opened their sweets at midday, and I said to him, hold on, we're going to have lunch first of all, and then after lunch they disappeared, he didn't remember, and then I would give him something that I'd made and a substitute. And I would say to them, you know, if they'd say to me, could I have that, I'd say, I love you way too much to let you have that. I love you way too much because that is not good for you and it's not doing good. But do you know what? Here's something better. Yeah. I love you too much for that. Yeah. So, and I'd say, you know, you can't have that because I love you too much, because I want you to have the better stuff. And so start educating them. You educate them about everything else. And yet food, you know, this is something that we flood our body with, I don't know, sometimes 5-6 times a day. Look at the meals, look at the snacks, look at the drinks. You know, in every other way, we parent very strongly.
Yeah.
That bacon sandwich can be the equivalent to 5 cigarettes, that bacon sandwich that you have at the side of a football match. You know, so when we talk about other things, I know that sounds strong, but that's the reality of it. Yeah. And they need the nutrients at this point. So get that stuff out the house and decide, because you've said that you eat very well. Yeah. Why wouldn't they eat what you eat?
Yeah.
And it takes 6-7 times for a child to try food and to think, you know, for their flavors and for their mouths to adapt. If they're eating things with you know, that are heavily processed with sugars, with salts, the taste buds don't work properly, so of course they want that next time, because then that's their fix, as it were, on the salts and on the sugars and on those additives. Get that out the house, you know, cook things out of packets, show them the real stuff, get them into it, let them hold it, let them play with it, let them choose colors. You know, color is powerful in food. Let them choose colors, just count how many colours they've had each day, in terms, and I don't mean a packet of M&Ms, you know, count how many, you know, they've had the peppers, they've had the tomatoes, they've had the cucumber, how many colours have you had, and get them involved with it and bring them along with that. But when you're giving them something just straight out of a packet, it's quick, it's easy. I know it. I've had three children. Sometimes you just need to give them something. But it's, you know, I say in chapter one, it's about setting yourself up for success. It's about getting the bad stuff out. And, you know, I wouldn't put anything in my body that I hadn't read the ingredients label of. In fact, my first bit of advice is eat things out of packets. But if you're going to have things in the freezer for those quick times, make sure you use brands that you know, brands that you love, and understand what's on that label. Yeah. If it's more than two or three ingredients, it's probably too many. And if you don't understand something, don't put it in your body. Your body's your home for the rest of your life. And it's your children's home for the rest of your life. It's got to serve them through exams. You know, they've got to be mentally aware. They've got to be physically strong. And that's where it starts. That's the starting point. The tutor, right, it's here nor there. But how their body functions is key.
We talked about mental load in the first half of this conversation and how we've all got tons going on and everything else. So I admit this quite freely, my reaction when it comes to, especially with homeschooling, everyone being at home the whole time, my reaction when it comes to a Thursday or Friday or Saturday night, usually end of the week, of I'm exhausted, I've had a week full of trying to manage everything, the kids are hungry, I'll just grab something out of the freezer, which inevitably turns out to be a pizza or a something. And I'll wholeheartedly admit, because I can't be bothered to think about anything else apart from just getting something in them, so then they'll leave me alone for an hour or so.
It's
changing mindset, isn't it? And again, I don't know how to do this yet. I need to read your book, I expect. But it's changed that mindset, if that's not the way to approach that particular problem about feeding them. How can I approach it in a more positive way that makes me happy to be doing it? Doesn't feel like a chore to me. I suppose there's a multitude of ways of reframing it, I suppose, isn't there?
Yeah, well, it's this thing when we do anything, why are you doing it? What's the biggest reason you're doing it? And for me, you know, I was diagnosed with stress-induced chronic fatigue. All my joints were hurting. I had probably seven operations, nearly bled out on the table twice. For me, there, you know, it's a, I want to be around for a very long time for my children. I want to be around, should I be a grandparent? I want to be able to support them. I don't want them to have to support me. I want to be in the best physical shape I can. I don't want to be in a bad way. And I want them to also understand the power. As I said, we have relationships throughout our life, but I don't think there is any more important than the relationship that we have with food. So the mindset is around, well, how important is it? Why? And when you get your whys right, the excuses that you give yourself on a night when you're exhausted and tired just won't cut it. You know, if your why isn't big enough, we say this coaching all the time, if your why isn't big enough, your excuse will be. So you understand yourself. Why is this important? What are you giving yourself? Because sometimes we're tired and we're cranky and we're anxious, and it all comes down to food. Our gut is the center of our mental well-being and our physical well-being. Most of our serotonin is made in our gut. So when your children are high and low and, you know, the moods are everywhere, you need to think about their food first. Yeah. And so it's really building an understanding with that and connecting and understanding why this is important. And then, you know, last night when I've got calls and everything else, why is it important for me to do this? Well, I don't even have to go there anymore. It's, you know, for me, it's I'm on autopilot. I get in the kitchen and that's it. But I talk about there's very easy ways to do it. It's doing some swaps. So you don't have to get pasta out completely, but it's getting the spelt pasta in, the lentil pasta in, the pea pasta, the this, the that. And then nourishing up, and it's slowly, slowly changing that bolognese sauce that you've always had and sneaking in eight veggies, which you can do so easily and it still tastes amazing. You know, spaghetti bolognese has always been, and I've changed it over the years because now I'm entirely plant-based. But from the days when I used to do sort of a turkey bolognese and now I do a wonderful organic soya bolognese, it is still my three teens, and teens, you know, people say to me all the time, oh, teens just won't eat that stuff. Yes, they will, if it tastes good enough. Yeah. You know, it's still of all the things I cook, and I cook a whole variety of things, it's still the thing that they say, oh yeah, love that, mum. You know, however often you do that, it's always one of our favorites. Yeah. And it's changed over the years. As I've become more aware of different things, and I've, you know, upped the ante, and I know that I'm off here on the scale, but I always say to people, you know, in terms of a diet, I'm sorry, I can't sort of say that there is any healthier diet than plant-based. Although, let me just, there's a, you know, I have to say an aside to that, everybody's different and our bodies do work differently. So that's my generalization, while people's bodies do work differently. So I say, in terms of, you might never want to eliminate meat, and that's fine. Just get yourself up on the scale somewhere so that you're aware of what you're packing in, and that is a really big part of that diet, whether you're keeping meat or not.
We do have turkey mince, I'm glad to say. That's our,
yes.
We don't have any beef anymore in that sense.
Yeah.
And we do have edamame pasta.
Lovely, Holland and Barrett. Yes, yeah. I love edamame. Yeah. Edamame is one of my snacks in there. Mine love edamame.
Yeah, so just mine actually. So it's
steaming them in pods, yeah, and just letting them then put their own chili or garlic salt or whatever on. That's fantastic. But yeah,
it's really interesting what you say about their taste buds actually, because again, this is on me as the parent. I'm making assumptions that if I try and make them try something new or different, my assumption is they won't like it. So I'm not, with everything, but with some things, I'm not going to bother trying to make them like it, because I just say no, and then we'll get an argument about it, and we'll say, see, told you wouldn't like it, why'd we bother making it, oh, and it all ends up in an argument. But actually, if what you're saying is right about the taste buds changing over not that long a period, a few days potentially, and you get them involved in choosing those different things, which they may not have tried before, but they choose the ones they want to try rather than me putting it upon them, then actually it should be a fairly simple swap out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a pizza in my book. One, you can buy some really lovely bases now, and you can get, you know, you can get them to do it. And that's a double quick pizza. Yeah, yeah. But that's a win-win, because you put the ingredients on, you've chosen them yourself. And I do stuff my pizza with broccoli and spinach and kale and stuff, but maybe that's just me. But, you know, there are different ways to do it. But I also will make dough for them. Again, this is still one of their favorites. It's been, you know, their favorite over the years. Again, they'll put all the stuff out, all the things that we have on it, the olives and the onions and the capers and the, you know, the mushrooms and whatever it is. So we have all this stuff out. I do the dough, it takes me 2 minutes. You're just mixing a bit of water, a bit of oil and some flour, divide it into five, they go, they roll it out, they do their pizza. And it's, you know, and it's lovely. It's one of the most special things for their birthdays. They're, you know, not my daughter. My daughter is, it's funny. You bring them up the same way. And, you know, they've all had the same experiences, the same food. And my daughter, she's the foodie. So she will, on a night, the boys, you know, and they are teenagers, so they do go out and they are exposed to other different things. But they will come back and they would still say, oh, would you make a pizza, mum, or whatever? My daughter, she'll eat a pizza. But actually, rather than have any takeaway, anything else, she will say, have you got leftovers, mum? And she wants home-cooked good food all the time. So she will often have whatever I've cooked for dinner, she'll come down and say, can I have it for breakfast? And I say, yeah, of course you can. Of course you can. That's a really good breakfast. So, it's funny. The boys are very, I would go off and I would have my pizza and I would do that. And shall we get Kokora or, you know, do this when they're going out? But she would say, actually, I'm coming home, mum, could you cook for me? Brought up the same way. It's just crazy, isn't it?
It is crazy. I think that's something we've also done, is reduce our takeaway consumption, which wasn't massive anyway. But for January and February, we basically haven't had any. And actually, not only is the food better that we cook, obviously, at home, and way cheaper, because these prices of these takeaways now are ridiculous.
Yes.
But also, inevitably, every single time the takeaway is pretty mediocre.
Even
healthy, in inverted commas, it's pretty mediocre. So you end up actually feeling unsatisfied, frustrated, out of pocket, and it's probably taking an hour to get the food because it's come from wherever it's come from. Whereas 20 minutes in the kitchen, you've cooked something you know is going to be tasty, you know you're saving money, and the whole experience is better, not just the food itself.
Yeah, so
you've really come to realise is actually just doing it yourself, you're feeling more in control, and it's a better outcome for everybody.
Yeah, definitely. Someone was saying, I'm running a sugar challenge this week, and someone said to me, what do you do about when you, you know, what you, when you go out, what places do you go to? I said, look, you almost get to a point where you know that the food that you make in your kitchen is going to be better than anything you ever go out and have. And unfortunately, you have an empty experience where you would, exactly like you've just described, where you invariably walk away thinking, I've spent a lot of money and actually I could have made something so much nicer, taste better, you know, my own ingredients, I know where they've come from. So unfortunately, you do get so far and you realize that actually this, that just doesn't work anymore. I don't enjoy that. But, you know, that's a good place to be.
Yeah,
that's a good place to be.
Small steps, yeah. As you say,
yes,
to get into the ideal situation. So, Kara, I think we're probably coming to the end of our time together. But I think I want to have a separate podcast with you. Just, I think, on the nutrition. I think we'd go on for hours about nutrition.
Actually,
a special. Maybe we'll do some kind of Q&A or something. Actually, because I think that'd be great. There's so many people in a very similar boat to me that I talk to regularly. Friends, and family, and clients who are all stuck in this kind of, what do we do to make it better for our kids? And we just don't know where to start, really.
And you do
know where to start because you've written a book about it.
Yes.
So
So
aside from everyone buying your book, because that's a great place to start, what is the best way to get hold of you?
So you can get hold of me. I'm on, as we were discussing earlier, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I am available on most platforms. So you can drop me a DM. I'm on Facebook as Eat, Nourish, Flourish. I'm on Instagram and I'm on LinkedIn as Carrie Davis Monroe. But you can get hold of me on my website, www.eatnourishflourish.com. There's a, you can directly send me a message there, or Carrie@eatnourishflourish.com if you want to send me an email. So many different ways to contact me. Yeah.
And all the ways.
Yes. Yes. Sadly, I think that's really sad. Yes.
Again, a whole other discussion about the world we live in now.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
World.
Yeah, I think I'd prefer not to be on any of them, but there we are.
I know. And you also have a Facebook group, don't you, where you share recipes and tips and insights as well.
Yeah, I do. And easy to find me because I have a page, Eat, Nourish, Flourish, but I also have a group, Eat, Nourish, Flourish. So you can find me there on Facebook as well. Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, so it's been amazing talking to you, Kara, a number of levels, all kinds of topics we've covered today. So thank you.
Yeah, no, it's been really lovely to chat to you. So thank you so much for having me on.
I'm going to organise a separate, I think, nutrition focused one as well, I'm sure, in the near future.
Yeah, that would be great.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Kara. Take care.
What a fascinating conversation with Kerry. There's just so much I can learn from her. And even though she won't say it herself, she's an incredibly brave woman. And everything she's dealt with throughout her life, she's just come through stronger and more determined, I think, to help people through a number of different challenges. Her main passion, obviously, being food and nutrition. So if you enjoyed this episode, please follow and share. And I look forward to seeing you next time.